So, Daniel, we just witnessed what has been described as the largest protest rally in Israel history. On Sunday night, about 500,000 people took to the streets to protest against the government's proposed judicial reforms. What can you tell us about these reforms and why so many Israelis are opposed to them?
Right. Well, the reason so many Israelis are opposed to the reforms is because they're not really reforms. That's sort of an Orwellian term that the coalition has used to describe what others have called a coup, a judicial coup, or a judicial revolution. I think the most accurate way of describing it is this is an attempt to upend the system of checks and balances that Israeli democracy has relied on for the decades since Israel's inception. Israel's democracy is fragile in many senses. And unlike in the United States or in other countries, there's only one house of parliament. It's a unicameral legislature. Whoever controls the government, whoever is in control of the government, is almost by definition the coalition that controls the parliament. There's no written constitution. And in the absence of all of that, what Israel has is an independent judiciary. And that judiciary has acted over the course of Israel's existence to serve as a very vital check on governmental power, on executive power. And the package of bills that Netanyahu and his ultra-right-wing governing coalition were attempting to push through, to really railroad through the legislature, would have stripped the High Court of Justice of its, or would strip the High Court of Justice, the Supreme Court, of its independence, of its power of judicial review, would have given the ruling coalition almost total control over judicial selections. Again, remember, without the kinds of checks and balances that many other countries,
including the United States, without the guardrails that are existing, say, for example, in other modern democracies. Now, the protests have actually been going on for more than 2 months. We just learned that Netanyahu could pause, or he's pausing, pushing through with the reforms. What happened over the weekend that could explain this new posture?
Yes, as you said, the protests have been growing and growing for the last several months. And what really caused things to reach the breaking point was when Netanyahu's defense minister, defense minister Gallant, a member of Netanyahu's party, a conservative sort of right-wing Knesset member, but a former general who is now the defense minister, publicly announced that he was so concerned about the effect that the judicial overhaul attempt was having not only in the country at large, where so many hundreds of thousands of people were saying, no, you can't strip our democracy of this check and balance, but in particular, the problematic impact it was having on the Israeli defense forces and the security forces. And here he noted that that hundreds, perhaps thousands of reservists. Israel is a small country. It's got a very powerful army, but that army relies on reserve soldiers. In particular, the Air Force relies on reserve pilots and navigators to carry out its mission. And as the judicial coup of the Netanyahu coalition moved further and further along, more and more reservists said, look, if this country is no longer going to be a democracy, we are not going to show up for service, and we're not going to follow the orders of an anti-democratic ruling coalition, of an autocracy. And after the defense minister held a press conference saying that he could no longer support the judicial, quote, reform, unquote, package, Netanyahu unceremoniously fired him. And that seemed to be the sort of trigger for this latest wave. Hundreds of thousands of Israelis sort of poured out of their homes onto the streets of the city when news of the firing of the defense minister was reported. And it seems like that was the thing that triggered this last wave, which broke the dam and seems to have convinced Netanyahu and his partners, you know, in addition to the months of building protests throughout Israeli society, in tech, in finance, in the army, pressure from allies around the world, including the U.S., that seems to be, that reaction seems to be the thing that made him realize that he needed to press pause.
And I wanted to ask you finally, I think you touched upon this a little bit. What has been the Biden administration's position on this whole situation, given that the U.S. is one of Israel's strongest allies in the world?
Yeah, the Biden administration, look, the Biden administration did not want to have a problem with Israel right now, right? The Biden administration is facing all kinds of problems and challenges around the world, from Russia's war in the Ukraine to a rising China to climate change to the pandemic to the threats against democracy here at home and in Europe and elsewhere. And the last thing they really needed or wanted was to tangle with the Israelis. But they were left with little choice as Netanyahu proceeded along this path to ram through legislation that would essentially turn Israel into a non-liberal democracy on the Hungarian or Turkish line. And remember that all of this is happening at the same time, and in many ways related to this, is the deterioration in the West Bank, which is now in the 56th year of Israeli occupation. With a growing settlement enterprise, bringing more and more Israeli civilians into the West Bank. And over the last months of this government coming to power, and even before that, there has been rising violence where settlers have attacked Palestinians, Palestinians have attacked settlers, instance of terrorism, shooting. So things seem to be threatening to spiral out of control there, and Israel was threatening to spiral out of control internally, domestically. And the Biden administration began to signal several months back already, you know, first through the U.S. ambassador to Israel and through Secretary Blinken, that that democracies did not push through radical transformative legislation and policies without a consensus and without some kind of internal domestic conversation. So these gentle signals sort of escalated to the point where, and remember, what's happening in the West Bank and what Israel is doing in terms of even as they're supposedly negotiating with Palestinians in Jordan with American mediators and in Egypt, they're passing laws in response to acts that Palestinians have taken. They're passing laws that would make it easier for Israeli settlers to reach territory that they had been prohibited from going to. Finally, the United States actually summoned the Israeli ambassador to the United States, who interestingly is the brother of the president of Israel, a ceremonial position, to the State Department for a reprimand about one of these laws that would have allowed settlers to access territory in the West Bank that is meant to be for Palestinians in some kind of final resolution. So these twin dynamics, right, which again are related because the people behind the attempt to radically eviscerate the power of the High Court of Justice, the Supreme Court, are leaders of the settler camp. The finance minister Smotrich, the national security minister Ben-Gvir, these are major settler leaders, part of the radical ultranationalist religious community in Israel. So they have a shared agenda, and the Biden administration has now had, including, by the way, the conversation with Netanyahu and Biden the other day, in which Biden gave the prime minister a lecture about the merits of democracy and the way democracies have to work. And then finally, the fact that that we have not yet issued to Netanyahu the traditional invitation to the White House is a clear signal to the Israelis that the administration is displeased. And beyond the administration, growing numbers of U.S. senators, staunch friends of Israel, have been questioning what's happening in Israel and suggesting even that should Israel continue down this path, that the United States should rethink the way it engages with Israel in terms of the aid and support that the country supplies Israel, which, as you noted earlier in your question, is you know, that we're Israel's biggest ally. And before the war in Ukraine, they were the biggest recipient of U.S. aid.
Daniel, thank you so much for taking time to chat with us and giving us this great insights on what is happening in Israel right now. Really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thanks, Jackson.